Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Newsroom Robots, the podcast where we explore the intersection of artificial intelligence and the news industry. I'm Nikita Roy, data scientist, media entrepreneur, and one of the many founders currently building their ventures at the Harvard Innovation Labs. On the Newsroom Robots, I'm excited to bring you insightful conversations with industry experts about how AI is impacting the way we do journalism. Joining me on the show today is Ezra Ayman. He's the Director of Strategy and Innovation at the Dutch public broadcaster NPO. With nearly 20 years of experience in the industry, Ezra has been on the forefront of media, innovation, and journalism. In today's episode, Ezra shares his insights on how to build an AI strategy for news organizations and highlights how NPO is using AI. Hi, Ezra. Welcome to Newsroom Robots. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, hi, Nikita. Thank you very much for having me. It's been excited for this moment.
Same here as well, Ezra. Your newsletter, The Wayfinder, is actually one of the ways in which I keep up with AI trends and media, and your thoughts and takes on how AI is influencing the media is something that has informed my perspective a lot. So I'm very excited to kind of get this opportunity today to actually talk to you a lot more about how you are thinking the future of AI is going to be impacting media, and especially as your role at NPO, which is the Dutch public broadcasting in Netherlands. I'm very interested to actually understand more in terms of how the broadcasting industry, the radio industry over there can think more about AI and hear more about the experiments that you're doing. And I want us to kind of, to get a bit more of context, especially for our listeners, to be able to understand, could you kind of describe, first of all, NPO, the way it's structured, and kind of what the AI journey has been so far like for the corporation?
Yes, certainly, because I think that's very important to understand. I remember from our preparation and your mails, you told me about that. Tell me about the AI strategy of your newsroom. And I wanted to say, okay, the NPO is actually a big umbrella organization that holds together 13 public broadcasters. So in the Netherlands, we have a decentralized public broadcasting system, and it has very much to do with, we want to make sure that we represent the whole of Netherlands with all the perspectives and age groups. And rather than doing that in a central organization, we have a decentralized organization. So certain broadcasters are more tailored to younger audiences. Others are more to older audiences. There might be more progressive people that have a different perspective on matters, and there might be more conservative. So we bring that all together, which means that there is not such a thing as one newsroom, although we have a task-specific news organization, NOS, that does the daily news broadcasts and really brings the factual information. But we have 12 other broadcasters that bring their own news shows, analysis, background information, that have radio shows. So there's plenty of newsrooms that we hold together in the umbrella NPO. So you can also imagine that coming up with an AI strategy is somewhat of a puzzle. And certainly with the new wave of generative AI, when I came in, which is 8 months ago, the first thing was really trying to understand what is everybody doing? How are we actually exploring this? It was very scattered. It was not directly connected to overarching goals. And some of our newsrooms and organizations are more than 1,000 people. And others are 60. So there's a different, quite a different variation of how people approach this in a very large organization versus a very small team. So what we did was really bring together the existing use cases and also seeing if there were already some common principles in how we wanted to work with AI. And from that, we started building what I call a strategy rocket, which is a way to kind of structure elements of a strategy and set a destination so that we can also tie it to our public mission. We have a very defined public service media mission that's being of public value to everyone in the Netherlands, ensuring that we have an offer that is relevant, recognizable, and appreciated for all of the Dutch people, regardless of their age, gender, of their background, of their disabilities, or of their educational level. So, and we have to do that in the places and the moments that these audiences are consuming media. So that gives us a quite broad palette of things that we have to fulfill and make sure that it's rooted in the Dutch society with the topics and themes that are relevant for the people in the Netherlands and that bring them together. So all of that sounds and might be high level, but it does give us some directions in terms of we have to make sure that it's accessible, that it's universal, that it's very much based on those topics and themes that are relevant for the Dutch society. And that gives you already kind of goals in which you can see how does AI help us to achieve some of these goals? Could AI help us to make our offer even more locally relevant or make it even more accessible or make a differentiation between age groups in terms of the complexity of the language that we use? So all of these things come into play once you have those strategic kind of guidelines and principles in place.
And this is very interesting, learning about the way the Dutch public broadcasting NPO is structured, actually. You have so many of these independent broadcasters. It seems like you have quite the task then to really understand how all the different broadcasters are using AI within their newsroom, being able to put that all under one overarching strategy for NPO and putting together guidelines and guiding them in through that. I'm really curious, how have you been able to understand all of the different use cases or be able to help organizations which are maybe like 60 people versus like 1,000 people, a completely different resource between the two newsrooms? What's like the difference in bringing together and getting them all under the same kind of strategy of NPO?
Yeah. So the good thing is, of course, that we are working already a long time together as public broadcasters. And the way that NPO is structured is that we own and operate all the channels. So both the linear channels, but also the digital outputs. And so there is a very structured way in how broadcasters pitch their proposals, but also their innovation proposals, because we're also managing the innovation budget to the NPO. And this gives us already a community of practice and the right people to discuss our AI strategy with. And the first thing that we did was really to a big collection of all the use cases, a big collection of all the experiments, and structure them according to, first of all, where they are in the value chain. In terms of, are they're somewhere at the beginning from the sourcing, or were they more in the production phase or more in the distribution side of things? And if you use that way of discussing AI use cases. It makes it very easy to do this, even from a 60 people perspective or from a 1,000 people perspective, because that workflow, just going from the first source to the final distribution, is quite recognizable. It's somebody everybody has to do. You just have more resources or more tools to do it if you're in a bigger organization. But it puts a common, and then on the, I would say if that's the horizontal layer, that workflow, then the goals and our public service media goals are the vertical layer. So you can then start seeing how does it contribute to making it accessible and to all audiences, and where could an AI tool in the sourcing side of things help to the accessibility, or where could something in the distribution side help to that accessibility, and that quickly helps to go from a pile of possibilities, a pile of experiments, to more structured map and grid almost of use cases that either fit very well into that strategic matrix, or ones that are a poorer fit that you feel like this is a nice to have, but it doesn't really contribute so much to our public service media goals.
And you were talking about having these use cases across this entire news workflow, basically from sources all the way to distribution. Where are the use cases mainly falling under, do you see? What are the top use cases you're seeing across your organization?
Well, I would say that currently, and of course, we didn't start with AI last year. There were a lot of AI, or at least algorithmic-driven processes already there, and most of them in the back end. So not so many front end facing or consumer facing or audience facing experiments. Although we did some under the umbrella of innovation, because if you put a big sticker innovation on it, you're more allowed to do things than if you have to do it in your kind of regular work. So a lot in the production, I would say, using AI for transcription of podcasts, transcription of video, labeling of metadata, which is a painful process, but if you can structure it better with AI, it really, really helps your discovery also. Using AI to assist with editing, certainly for video material, but also for audio material, it helps to clean up edits, to find highlights, spot highlights, these kind of things. Using it for preparing subtitling or translations. We use it in the recommendation of our video player or kind of video on demand service. And we're currently, with a new wave of AI tools, we're looking into how we can help with storyboarding for shows, because AI helps you to visualize ideas. And a lot of time went in kind of preparing or pitching a program, and that required some artwork to kind of bring that to life. And with AI, you can use AI tools so much quicker come to these storyboards and to come to kind of illustrate story ideas as well.
As you were saying, for the storyboard idea, generative AI especially is kind of this creative powerhouse, but at the same time, it has a lot of the limitations in the sense that it can be unreliable and hallucinate. And so when you're thinking about, I'm thinking about user-facing products, are you thinking a lot about how generative AI could help out over there?
Yeah, so that's why I said that most of the things I said so far were preparing, brainstorming, helping in production and making that more efficient, which is the easy, the low-hanging fruit. They're not necessarily transformative. They're just speeding things up and freeing some work. If we are currently looking into audience-facing products, these are very much centered around accessibility or expanding our offer to more audiences. A good example is our news service, which is our general news service, NOS. They have an ID or a kind of part of their work. It's called News in the Easy Language. It is their main news bulletins often contain words that are from the political world, or they're quite complex, and not everybody can follow these news bulletins. There's a team that's dedicated to make those news bulletins easier. So they make easy versions of the 7 o'clock news or the 8 o'clock news. But as you can imagine, that requires a lot of manual labor, listening, transcribing, then finding alternative ways to express things. And if there's one thing that language models can do very well is give you language alternatives for complex sentences. So the kind of preparation, like how could I rephrase this in an easier way? How could I explain this word in an easy way? That's something that certainly a language tool can really speed up. So that's one thing. What we're also trying to do is experimenting with making, so the multimodality of AI is quite interesting for accessibility. How do you make people that have auditive disabilities listen to a podcast? We're experimenting with visual enhancements of podcasts and making that part of the narrative is generated as an image that tells a story of a podcast so that you can not only experience a podcast as something that you listen to, but you can also so visually experience it.
Like automatically creating a podcast content into a video?
Yeah. So people that are not completely capturing everything in the podcast, they also can partially experience the podcast in visuals.
And you touch upon the multimodality of it. And we also have a lot of these synthetic voices coming out. And you see all of these avatars here in the US. We had last year, they had announced their launch, Channel One, which was having AI avatars telling the news, basically, human AI avatars. And when people see all of that, and especially in the news industry, people in broadcasting, in radio, see the ability of synthetic voices and AI avatars, there's a bit of fear of organizations doing that. Where do you see the line being for using all those kinds of like synthetic voices and AI avatars, something that Channel One did over here?
Yeah, so the kind of broad use of synthetic voices we're currently not yet considering, but we are exploring. Could we synthesize certain voices of our broadcast hosts in order to read news articles? Because we are not only making radio shows and broadcasts, but we also have textual outputs on our websites. And it might be quite nice that you can also listen to them as audio updates in your car, or for people that cannot read, to just have them spoken out. And then rather than using a generic voice that they might not recognize or trust, why don't you use your own voices? So, but that's, I would say that's a different use case than giving those voices kind of generated texts or something else. So we're using the textual output is still something that we have written with the news team, and that's then spoken out with synthetic voices. These are kind of experiments that we're considering, but they're not yet broadly adopted. But we also use them in more specifically to enrich our storytelling or to kind of push the boundaries of storytelling. A really interesting case that we had was a recent podcast on JFK, where we had unique diaries of a Dutch investigative journalist who died a few years back. But he was very closely involved in the JFK inquiries and was even, and he had a few theories that kind of opened the mystery again. And quite recently, the diaries of this Dutch investigative journalist were discovered and given to the public broadcaster. And rather than asking somebody to read those diaries for the podcast, we synthesized the voice of that investigative journalist who was not longer there. So we had a discussion with the family, and throughout the podcast, the voice of the journalist is brought back to life to read his own diaries. And that made the story so much more powerful.
Yeah, so much more impactful in that particular case that you're talking about, because it was his story, but he was not there to tell it.
And it's a thin line because, of course, we had to consider all the aspects of this. In this case, that there was a real good conversation with the family to make sure that we could do it. And we also had the feeling that given the time and effort that the journalist did to keep these diaries and to pursue the story, that he would have appreciated the effort. But it's not something that you can repeat so easily. We had a few campaigns here in Belgium, where I live, where a dead politician was actually used to do a campaign for his party. and that was less appreciated by the audience.
I can imagine. Yeah, it also, like, in the similar space, the AI avatars for, like, broadcasting, when people are talking about, do you see that being also very use cases for that being there in the industry? We are seeing some places having these AI avatars read the news and do that. And it's so easy to clone and create an AI avatar right now.
Again, I don't see us directly doing that, because the trust people have in familiar faces. However, there might be specific use cases, and I'm thinking about, I know that in Switzerland, the regional TV stations are using avatars to do regional news, not regional news, but regional weather forecasts, because they don't have the resources and the people to make those bulletins for every region and very local. But through the use of AI avatars, they've been able to scale, which normally would be just a map on a website. They've been now be able to really have presented weather forecasts, which are better appreciated by the audience and also help them better understand the weather than just those flat maps which were put online.
And one thing I was seeing, I've heard about when you were talking in one of your talks, you were talking about being a filmmaker before, a journalist, and that was your kind of start of your career. And so I'm very interested, for someone who has had this film background, there's a lot of issues around IP and, like, image and video generation tools. How have you been?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And kind of thinking about the ability of these, especially image and video generation tools, the capabilities that they have now, has that been, like, absolutely blowing your mind with the dreams of how it could edit and do things that when you started off must have taken you a really long time?
Yeah, I told you that I started as a fiction filmmaker, and I quickly moved to documentaries because of the hard journey it is to put a fiction film together and the huge budgets that you need. Nowadays, if you see, or at least you feel the potential of the keyboard being your new camera and whatever you write can come to life, I really think that will unlock a whole new generation of people that have ideas to visualize those ideas just from their heads to something that becomes a moving image. And I'm really excited about that part. The question is, of course, what's the basis of those generated images? And how do we make sure that they're fairly, that they're based on a kind of fair use or kind of fairly agreed IP conditions?
Yeah, and when you're talking about the IP conditions, there's also this big IP issue for large language models being trained on news content. And a lot of the step that publishers are right now taking is basically locking up their content from the GPT bots coming and crawling them so that they don't have access to it anymore. It does not show up on Microsoft's Copilot search or Bard, and they're not even being trained on it. And there's this whole question on, do we do that? Is that the right step? Or do we kind of collaborate with these tech companies right now? And where is the line? What's your opinion on that?
Currently, we're blocking, or at least we have agreed at the public broadcaster level that we don't want creators to use our content to train the models. First of all, because there is not yet a dialogue with any of these parties. They're considering the big American companies, the usual suspects, but anybody, all the rest of the news industry in other countries, they're far away from being considered for conversations. So, and without any conversation and on the conditions, you can not agree to it, I think, because you don't know how it will be used and also what the long-term perspective on this is. So that's our current point of view. I also wonder if the partnerships in the long term are helping the industry. There's, of course, a perspective that if we are absent of the training model, the data and the training model, then in the end, it will only be fed by poor quality information. But on the other hand, if we improve the model to that point that we're not necessary anymore, you might also dig in your own grave.
It's interesting you're talking about they have not approached, there's no conversations with somebody as big as NPO over there in Europe. What would be the kind of the conversation or middle ground that you think you would want to see with these tech companies?
Yeah, and I say NPO, but from my public broadcasting colleagues, I know that maybe except for BBC and maybe our colleagues in France or Germany, there's no public broadcaster that's approached in the whole of Europe. It's always with the tech companies like this. They look at the big markets. Europe for them is difficult. It's fragmented. It's many languages. It's many parties you have to talk to. Every country has their different kind of conditions and rules and guidelines that are still making that you cannot just cookie cutter your partnership across the continent. So we're mainly not in the first in the row to have those conversations. So.
Do these large language models hold up in the Dutch language as much as in the English language? Do you see, is that probably a reason?
Well, they certainly, the kind of quality they're currently providing is acceptable, but we are, of course, also in the Dutch market, also looking into the possibility of a more specific own Dutch large language model. There's just different parties within the country that are exploring, not just for news, but for anything that could be a public service, from cultural institutions to the government to news providers. Kind of building an own Dutch large language model would help those institutions.
Could you share more about that? Because I'm curious. So these are like Dutch large language models specifically, then being trained on the language, more kind of like fine-tuned for the language over there. And are those kind of companies or areas where you see collaboration being more likely than with like big giants like OpenAI?
We're at the very start of the discussion here. There's an initiative that is looking to build a large language model for the Dutch language, and it's now opening the conversation with interested parties. And we as NPO, we also have to see and consider how could we be part of that and contribute to that. But there is a conversation. So there you can talk to each other. What would be the value? How do we want to build this? What kind of data are we using? What are the kind of expectations of this? How much would it cost? How much time would it take to develop it? And how different would it be from something that's in a few months is here from OpenAI? So all these things still are being considered. But what's different here is at least you're part of the conversation.
As you said, I think it's so important to have that dialogue at least with the companies that are building these large language models. And it seems like this initiative is taking that approach. I'm very curious, when you see the value of collaborating with an initiative like that, like where's the value that you're looking, what are you looking for from this? Because at the same time, even if a Dutch initiative creates a large language model, there's also the risk over there, right? Of them being able to kind of replace there.
First of all, if we participate, we can also shape the conditions. We are contributing to the quality of it and making sure it actually understands the nuances of the Dutch language. And it's less of a black box as well. So we really know, and we can justify, if we would use that model, we can justify how it was built and we can explain it, which is not the case if we use a kind of Silicon Valley-infused tech model.
Exactly. And do you see that probably being a path forward then, if you're not having these kind of like dialogues with the tech companies, especially for like European broadcasters or people who are not in the North American giants, basically?
I think there's always two paths forward. Yeah, we're so reliant on the American tech companies, not only because of the audience-facing platforms that they run, but also for our infrastructure from cloud servers to computational power and softwares, that it's a bit unthinkable that we step away completely from them. But it's good to have also local alternatives and to show that you're investing in it. I think in terms of having that conversation and relationship with them, we need to have a more European dialogue. That's why we are so invested in working together with European broadcasters, and the EBU plays a big role, and they could have a unified voice towards some of these tech companies, say like we're talking on behalf of the European broadcasting industry, or at least on behalf of the public service broadcasters, which is a better conversation starter, I would say, than saying we're only here from the Netherlands or only here from Belgium, Luxembourg, Switzerland, whatever.
Coming together as a bigger impact in that way.
That's at least the idea, and it's not always easy, but I think that's the only way forward for us is to collaborate, to partner, to find European ways to shape an agenda, to shape our vision, and also have the conversation based on that agenda.
Exactly. The future of news seems to be collaboration from what I'm hearing and hearing from you here.
Yeah, well, it's always like, let's compete on content, but collaborate on technology. Because I feel in the end, why people choose us is because we have a certain relationship, we have a certain voice and view. Not necessarily because our AI model was so specifically different than our competitor.
Exactly. And actually broadening it a bit more in terms of like the overall AI strategy, because I'm so curious in the role that you play. I'm very interested to kind of like understand from a practical perspective about how are you able to then decide on the different components of the strategy, because it's evolving so quickly and you're kind of unsure in terms of where things will play out. Do you go with like the startup ideas, the initiatives, wait and see what OpenAI has to come out with? And they seem to be advancing so quickly in their advancements over there. How do you kind of keep up with how quickly generative AI is evolving?
As an organization or as a person, I have, of course, my daily habit of making sure that I read the most important updates. And what I try to do, of course, is to structure that into things that have an impact now versus things that might have an impact on our long-term strategy. And we're trying to have an iterative strategy where on a regular base, we look at strategic goals that we defined and the new evolutions that are coming up and seeing, and do we need to adjust some of our strategies? And if so, has that an impact on budget, on resources, and some of our year or multi-year roadmaps? But that's a continuous process. I really don't believe that the idea that you make a 3 to 5 year plan and then rest back and watch how it will unfold, that's out of the window. You need a much more agile way of evaluate, adjust, and then kind of pivot sometimes your strategy.
And as someone who's keeping an eye on the trends of the industry, and especially like from the Wayfinder newsletter, and you write this Wayfinder annual report, which was so enlightening to see kind of like what the trends are and what's happened over the past year and where things are headed towards. What are you most excited about in the future of AI technologies, and especially how you see that the journalism industry evolving with that?
The one thing I'm most curious about is of course, when will we hit the ceiling and what does the ceiling look like of the current large language models, and the combination of multimodality, real time and mobile. So that triangle of everything moving to personal devices, AI chips that run on smartphones, the fact that things can be done real time, so I could translate whatever, I could speak Dutch now with you and you would hear it as English, and I could look like I'm Donald Trump and you wouldn't know. So all these things happening from your phone in it. Yeah, but at the same time, like we were talking about movie making, and I still have to come up with an idea, type that idea as a prompt, and it generates a an image, why wouldn't that be able something that we can do real time? You know, like if it's real time generated, then anything you film directly becomes something else, or anything you type becomes a movie that you can stream, so you can have a real interactive movie. There's a lot of possibilities once these models move into a kind of real-time capabilities, and also from mobile devices. Also very scary, very scary possibilities, but also very creative new possibilities. I yesterday had a conversation with somebody from Spotify, and we were thinking aloud at what would a conversational podcast look like. So you, rather than listening to a podcast, you have a conversation with a podcast.
That's also the part of the future, like very interactive news, possibly being able to just talk to the news. I feel like that's going to be like an exciting possibility with like multimodality, real time, the way you're talking about.
You already see it happening. I think yesterday or a few days ago, Roblox and launched their real time translation feature in the game. So I'm quite sure we'll very fast see new interactive media formats that make use of that real-time capability to change one format to another, to change from text to visuals, from visuals again to audio, from audio to whatever.
That's actually just bringing me up to another point. You see, like, the traditional way in which we have our links and we go to a homepage and or we get our news from social media, that kind of like distribution of news or the way news gets to people completely changing. Is that one area you see that AI and generative AI and all of these advancements might be able to really disrupt completely?
I do think so. I think search is already evolving. It becomes something that's much more a conversation, and you don't expect anymore a list of results, you expect an answer. And an answer is something really different than a search result. And in a search result, you want to be optimized to be first in the lists, while if it's an answer, then you will have to optimize to be part of the answer. And I would say that's a different kind of optimization.
And how, you actually brought up search and it just opened up a whole other question for me in terms of how concerned are you then with like generative AI search as a public broadcaster there in its ability to be able to summarize information? Because a lot of the news as well, if people are able to just take it and produce it in a different way and that gets fed into the models and it's still being retrieved, it's still like news as such, is the facts are not copyrightable. And that just leads to a whole different issue if that's a more easier way for people to engage with. So where do you see kind of the ability for journalism to evolve if it's not just like through search? Because that might just completely, completely go away as a source of traffic for news.
I think there's a few components there, of course. As a public broadcaster, in the end, what we want is that there is quality information that's accessible to a broad audience. In the first place, we want to have that in a destination that people can rely. So I really think that if these news kind of generative interfaces are becoming more used, but maybe less reliable, then certain destinations will become more valuable. So I'm quite sure that our destinations, if we keep them qualitatively very high, they will become even more attractive to a certain group of the audience. But we also have to make sure that those generative interfaces somehow can use trust signals or public value signals to pick up the right kind of information. So it's for us, we have to be in both places, actually, because the audience is in both places and we cannot just ignore part of the audience that's not finding us directly.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a very tricky time as well, just for the news industry to be able to understand the generative AI search and how to evolve with that. It's been so fascinating to understand really the way NPO has been functioning and putting that together and your entire perspective on building the AI strategy. But I also want to kind of wrap up with understanding from your personal experience with AI. You write this newsletter on AI as well in the Wayfinder. And so how are you using AI? Do you use AI for your newsletter in any way?
There's a lot of times that I collect a lot of links. I collect a lot of, I would say, draft material that I write either when I'm reading an article or just snippets that are explaining the article and why I think it's interesting. A lot of times for the newsletter, it needs to be condensed. It needs to be more structured. Otherwise, the newsletter would be three times as long. So I do use it to really come with a shorter versions of something I already written or more compact and concise ways to put things. I use it as well sometimes for coming up with a catchy title. Say like, okay, I've written this newsletter, give me 10 variations for a catchy title that really would summarize the point I made here. So mainly it's a brainstorm partner versus and a kind of copy editor that looks how can you make things more clear and more condensed.
I love it as a brainstorming companion, and I think it's something that I use to find titles as well. It's really helpful that way.
What it doesn't do well is actually, so I gave it once really my raw material, and I collect so many links in a week. And then I said, like, can you structure it so that all similar items are grouped together? Find me related items and group them in a paragraph, which I normally do. I look like, are there similar topics? How do I bridge from one to the other? It didn't really do a very good job in putting the right things together, making meaningful clusters, and also bridging from one topic to the other. Still a lot of work on my end there.
Yeah, the reasoning capabilities, you still needed that human judgment to be able to put it together. So, but it at least helps you get half the process done so you can do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Ezra, this has been so much fun diving into and learning a lot more about how the European side, and especially in broadcasting, you are thinking about AI. And thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, Nikita.
That was Ezra Ayman, the Director of Strategy and Innovation at the Dutch public broadcaster NPO. Stay updated with the Newsroom Robots podcast and sign up for our newsletter at newsroomrobots.com. This podcast is made possible thanks to the Harvard Innovation Lab Spark Grant. I'm Nikita Roy, and this is Newsroom Robots.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.